This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. Inspire change. Shape the future. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Connection is the greatest strength in the fight against suicide. Together, we can encourage those who are struggling to seek help and to know they're not alone. For free resources or to learn how you can get involved in their mission, visit afsp.org.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. At the end of this podcast, stick around for our rundown of the latest news right here in the Chicago area. But first, fighting food insecurity with a fresh take on an old story. The European folktale Stone Soup is all about community members coming together for a common good. Well, now we have Stone Soup Chicago. The new children's book reminds us how small acts of kindness can inspire cooperation and feed a community. And the literary project comes from an unlikely source, the Greater Chicago Food Depository. So in this episode of The Pod, we'll hear from a leader at the food bank and check in with the artists who brought Stone Soup Chicago to life. At the table was Jill Rockman, Chief Operating Officer of the Greater Chicago Food Depository, Sam Kirk, who's a multidisciplinary artist and storyteller and illustrator of Stone Soup, and John Jennings, who's an award-winning comics creator and publisher and author of the Stone Soup adaptation. We'll start with Jill on how this storybook came together.
It's an amazing creative process. The team came together, and we're always thinking of ways to disrupt the message, tell the story, break through, and really help neighbors understand the issues in creative ways. And we knew the story. The team brought forward the Stone Soup idea, and we said immediately, this amazing intersection between that centuries-old folktale mm-hmm. and the mission of the Greater Chicago Food Depository. And we just said, what if? Mm. What if we retold that story, today's Chicago, today's issues, and really create a love letter to Chicago? And what if we could find amazing artists to support us? And we were able to do that, and we're just so fortunate to have
them. And it's not just a what if. I mean, this is a children's book, right? So how do you know that something like that would work?
Well, we knew from the centuries-old tale that the story had been told, really, and it makes the issue understandably accessible mm-hmm. for young people. And like so many children's stories, there's messages there for the adult readers, the librarian who's going to read, the teacher's going to read. And so we thought there was just a great opportunity, and frankly, a unique opportunity for us to make the story accessible.
Yeah. So I want to hear from all of you. We're all parents here, as I understand it, right? Everyone's nodding. Yes. why is it important, do you think, for kids to know about food insecurity and food accessibility? I feel like, you know, there are so many, you know, what would seem complicated topics that we wouldn't necessarily talk to children about, but in this day and age, some of that has shifted, right? We've had to have some much more real conversations, more difficult conversations, and bring our kids to the table. So why food insecurity and why for kids? John?
First thing is that stories are empathy engines, right? They teach us how to connect to each other, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, this particular story, it is based off this idea of community. And, you know, early on, like, I think kids are introduced to these really, really complex ideas through fairy tales and stories, right? So the symbolism in it, I think, is actually pretty apparent. And updating it, you know, with Sam's work, I thought was, you know, it was a really wonderful, like, synergistic experience. And I think that the kids will be attracted to, like, the underlying, like, you know, the morals of the story.
Right.
And, you know, I think one thing that I love about the story is that it kind of gets across the idea that, you know, food is love, right? And love is a choice, right? And so I think those particular types of ideas are embedded in the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it works, I think, even in a modern day sensibility.
Yeah. What comes to mind for you, Sam, when you think of connecting kids with food accessibility?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the most powerful things we can do is to show kids how small gestures can make a very large impact. And food is an essential need. And so being able to show them that they have that power and that they can come together with community to do this, I think is just an easy way to help them understand what their impact on the world can be from a young age.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add, Jill?
My build would be that the story shares not only the issues that maybe are in place, but the role that you can play in terms of making the change. And it was true for I have a 26-year-old now, but that was always the challenge of, like, let's show what it looks like to be a citizen and to be someone, as you said, with empathy. And so this shows what it takes to have action.
Now, Sam and John, were you too familiar with this story before you joined on with the project?
I was vaguely familiar with this story.
Same.
Yeah.
But I'm very familiar with it now.
Yeah, well, really familiar with it.
Very, very different iterations of the story.
Well, tell me the story of how you got involved with the project.
I was contacted by my rep, who was connected with the food bank. And, you know, at first they were asking, like, did I want to illustrate it? Did I want to write it? You know, this is actually the first children's book I've ever written, you know?
Oh, this is the first?
It's the first one, yeah. And I don't know, I have a little boy, and I was like, I'm trying to transition into doing, you know, more things for younger readers. And I just thought it was just a really powerful idea. And, you know, it was an interesting problem to solve. I mean, to me, like, writing and storytelling is problem solving mm-hmm. as well. And this is definitely a really massive, like, you know, problem, you know, food insecurity. And so, you know, that's what attracted me to it. And then I think that working with Sam, I mean, because her work is so grounded in the spatial narrative that it actually, you know, she was a perfect illustrator for the book. So
I see. So, Sam, did John call you and say, hey, I've got this project?
No, actually,
you
Danny,
check it out.
Danny from the creators called me and asked me about collaborating with John.
Was it an immediate yes for you?
It was an immediate yes. One, I've done work with the Food Depository before, and I just really appreciate the work that they do. I see it in the community that I live in almost every day. Mm-hmm. And so there's a strong appreciation there, but also just the opportunity to illustrate something like this that I think also connects to Chicago's history. I mean, if we think about the Black Panther Party, the Young Lords, you know, a lot of where the Food Depository pantries are located are in many of those neighborhoods where that work, you know, started. And so for me, it was an opportunity to put like a fun spin, a modern spin on this story.
You know, the book is very timely, Jill, right? At the root here is a very serious issue. Food insecurity, as I understand it, continues to be on the rise.
Correct.
Paint the picture for us of what this looks like right now in the Chicago area. What are the numbers? I'm sure you've got the data.
Yeah, it's a great question. Food insecurity has always been an issue. It rose dramatically during COVID and really never came down. For so many people, recovery just didn't happen. And so there are about 1.4 million residents in Cook County who just find it hard to put food on the table. And we have seen those numbers stay high. We anticipate, I actually have seen data the first couple weeks in May, the numbers are higher in May than they were a year ago. And that's in part to things that are happening, you know, with inflation and the economy. In the last 5 years, groceries and rent have gone up 25% to 30%. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are not many listeners who can say their salaries have gone up 25% to 30% in the last 5 years. People can't keep up. Gas in the last couple of months has gone up 25% alone. Nobody's salary has really gone up.
And don't forget the federal funding cuts to programs like SNAP.
Exactly right. Coming to that. And so in May, we knew that there were, you know, we started the year knowing there was 450,000 people who were at risk of losing their benefits. And through just tremendous community collaboration and work through Save Our SNAP program, we drove awareness at the Food Depository with tremendous help from all parts of community. And we reduced that number down to about 100,000, which is still too many. But we saved 300,000-ish people from losing their benefits. That's just an incredible catastrophe, actually. Yeah. And so the need is high and it's going to be higher.
So sticking with you for a moment here, Jill, and before we dig more into this book, because it's great. I read the whole thing. I'm in love. I read it twice. I'm in love. I want you to just remind us of this, the greater mission here of the Food Depository and and the work that you're doing every day.
Yeah. So the mission at the Greater Chicago Food Depository is, our mission is to end hunger, full stop. And within that, we have a vision of every neighbor having three meals a day, every day, no exception. And we said that is our vision by 2030. And that is the work of pantries. That's the work of policy, creating policy change. It's the work of messaging. It's the work of volunteers. And so that work is incredibly important. And so our job is to find ways to galvanize all those small actions symbolic in the book of bringing community together to end hunger.
So, Sam, looking at the book here, I mean, beautifully done.
Thank you.
Talk to me about your process when it comes to the art, because I think the colors are quite bright and just vivid. You know, and part of it was making me think of my attempts in the past. I used to think I was, you know, a low-key artist myself. But the one thing I could never do was draw faces.
Okay.
And do it really well, because that's in itself, you know, a feat. But I love the style that you use to draw the faces of the two travelers. So talk to me about how you approach this one.
So this one, I mean, a lot of it came from John's script. I was eager to read what he wrote and see what his spin was going to be on it. And I really appreciated taking the journey through these two viewers, because I think it allowed us to see, what do people see when they come to a city like Chicago? And growing up here, I've really appreciated how community does come together.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of organizing, a lot of activism. And I think even in this book, you see how Chicagoans can come together and how something so simple as an invitation can prompt that. And so I really just wanted to make sure that there was definitely some iconic imagery, some of the buildings, some of the signage, but also the global landscape that is our residence. And so I think, you know, really just figuring out how to bring that together and to show, you know, how this story can touch so much, so many different parts of Chicago is really important.
Yeah. Your artwork is rooted in Chicago.
Yes.
Yeah.
So very much so.
How would you say the city, you know, inspired your color palette even?
My color palette entirely has to do with the personality of the people. I ride the train so often just because it's like content collection, you know, like I get to see how people's personalities shine. And color has a lot to do with it, between patterns, but also just like how we showcase that we're from here, you know, different selections that we use. And so, yeah, it's really just a way of celebrating the city.
Mm-hmm. John, you're a comic book creator and illustrator, but you're on the writing side of this project, your very first children's book.
Right.
I don't think it'd be your last, though. That's my
prediction.
I hope not. Tell me more about how you approach this one.
Well, one of the, like I said, you know, I believe that storytelling is problem solving, right? And like I mentioned that earlier. So I was thinking about what was presented. So we had to actually update the story so that these travelers would go through different neighborhoods, you know, in Chicago. And so that's why I came with the idea of making it more like a magical realist place or a space, or like an urban fantasy. And I like to work in that space, because a lot of times the speculative gives us a certain amount of distance from an issue, you know?
Yes.
And, you know, I think it definitely comes across here. And, you know, for me, it was also a no-brainer. Originally, I'm from Mississippi, but I've spent a lot of time in Chicago. It's my favorite city.
Mm.
I feel like a second home to me.
Good to know.
And so,
tell me more about how Chicago inspires you, you know, as someone who doesn't live here, but you're a frequent visitor.
One of my favorite things about it is just the class solidarity, as far as like just, you know, it being a working class space. You know, one of the names of Chicago is the City of Big Shoulders. I love that.
That's right.
You know, or the second city, because it basically rebuilt itself from its own bones. You know, it burned down totally and then, you know, rebuilt itself. You know, and so it's kind of like a phoenix. You know, other thing too is because it's founded by a black man, essentially, DuSable. You know, so I spent like a lot of time just looking at the ins and outs of the myths around Chicago, you know, and I try to integrate that as much as possible.
Nice.
So having these two travelers as the point of view, you know, I think, and I'm glad that they let me do that, you know, and I love the way it turned out.
Right.
Know? Yeah. So
it's great work. I want to share a little bit from the book. I'm going to read a little excerpt here. It says, "The people of Chicago added other things too, things that no vendor could sell them. These things grew inside of themselves. Some people brought love. Some brought kindness with them to share. There was tons of laughter added to the soup. A big, healthy cup of empathy was stirred in. empathy was a very powerful ingredient, to be sure. Another person added Chicago pride and hometown love. The sweetness of understanding lifted the flavor of the soup. Several people brought spoonfuls of grace and buckets of care. Everyone made the soup and fed each other. Piece by piece, suggestion by suggestion, the stone soup became Chicago. Isn't that beautiful? A summary of what John was just talking about. I loved how near the end of the book, there's a comparison, Jill, between how these Chicagoans came together and how your team founded the Food Depository back in the 70s.
Yeah, it was important for us at the very beginning our end game was to have a love letter to Chicago with this story. By still telling the story of the Greater Chicago Food Depository, our origin story, and what we firmly believe is that we are all greater together. And, you know, I would just say it was important that walking through communities was a core part of it. We believe strongly that so many of our communities are talked about and defined through the filter of their deficits.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe strongly there are so many assets to raise and to talk about and to be able to lift those in this book. And really all the work that we do was important. And John and Sam did that so beautifully. We were blown away by their work.
What do you want kids to take away from this book, John?
That the most important person or the most important asset is the person next to you, you know, that, you know, and to actually like push back against the, I think, deliberate segregation through media sometimes that we experience, and to understand that, you know, empathy is the greatest power. So,
Sam, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention you've been busy with not just this, but another major project. You collaborated on a mural at the Obama Presidential Center.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Real quick, what should we know about it?
So I collaborated with Dorian Sylvain, and this mural is a two-story piece at Home Court. So again, a community space, which is perfectly aligned with both of our
work. So when
we
said your work was rooted in Chicago, we meant it.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, Jill, leave us with this. Where can we find Stone Soup Chicago?
Well, you can get more information about it on chicagosfoodbank.org. At the Greater Chicago Food Depository. We are always happy to talk about it and invite volunteers to come.
Awesome. Jill Rockman is Chief Operating Officer of the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Sam Kirk is a multidisciplinary artist and storyteller, an illustrator of Stone Soup, and John Jennings is an award-winning comics creator and publisher, also author of Stone Soup. Thank you all so much.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you for having us.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
Now we'll turn to the top stories of the day in Chicago and Illinois. We checked in with three of our WBEZ colleagues, midday anchor Lisa Labas, arts and culture reporter Courtney Kippers, and senior editor for public safety Tom Shuba. We started with the mayor visiting the Pope in Rome. WBEZ City Hall reporter Mariah Wolfel is in Italy to cover the big international trip by Mayor Brandon Johnson. And Lisa is happy for her, but maybe a little jealous.
The only thing that makes me happier than me being in Rome is someone I really like being in Rome. And Mariah...
You're a better woman than me, Lisa, I've been hating on Mariah all week.
Sure, I'm jealous, sure. But, you know, thank goodness she's there. But she's working hard.
Yes.
You've said they're going to meet tomorrow. He's going to have this private audience with the Pope. The big news, the big takeaway from our conversation, he's not giving the Pope a Cubs hat.
Oh, thank goodness.
I know, right? But he will be presenting him with some other gifty items, including some jardiniere from J.P. Graziano Grocery on Randolph Street in the West Loop. He also wants to talk with the Pope about the encyclical the Pope released. This is like his position paper about humanity. The encyclical was entitled Safeguarding the Human Person in the Time of Artificial Intelligence. So they're going to be talking, hopefully, he thinks, about the risks of AI and what it presents to our shared humanity. Mm-hmm. They might be talking a little bit about crime issues in Chicago.
How long is this meeting?
Well, we don't know. It could be 5 minutes. It could be 2 hours. We really don't know.
Okay.
But I'm mostly interested, actually, aside from Mayor Johnson's meeting with the Pope, he will be meeting with the mayor of Rome on Friday. They're going to tour an affordable housing complex in Rome.
Oh.
Affordable housing, a really big challenge in Rome. You can search for any number of articles, like one I saw from theparliament.com, showing Rome is currently grappling with the severe structural housing crisis driven by stagnant wages. We had a big surge in short-term tourist rentals, lack of social housing. Rents went up. Last year was a jubilee year for the Catholic Church. This is a big, long, year-long celebration every 25 years.
Right.
So rents went way up, and lower and middle-income residents, they've been forced out of the central area.
Well, it sounds like a good opportunity for the two mayors to compare notes.
We'll see. We'll see what they can find out.
Well, Tom and Courtney, let me hear from you here, because, you know, in conversation with Lisa this morning, Mariah described the meeting that Mayor Johnson will have with the Pope as the biggest stage Johnson has been on thus far. And the story's already getting tons of media attention. What do you think, Courtney?
Yeah, so much attention. I got to say, I love having an international correspondent here WBZ.
So fun. That's right.
It's really fun to check in with Mariah. And yeah, certainly this is getting a lot of love here.
A lot of buzz. Tom, I'm sure it's on your radar, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know about the biggest stage, though. I mean, the mayor, welcomed people to the DNC a few years ago, right? Like, he had this great opportunity as a pretty young mayor to, like, host political luminaries and to kind of raise his stature. So, I mean, if we're comparing this Pope visit, which is obviously a big deal, I don't know if it compares as far as a stage to the DNC and getting that to Chicago.
That's a good point, Tom.
I disagree.
You disagree, Lisa?
I'm not a churchgoer, but I think that the Pope being a representative of the world, of Catholics around the world, I think this is a big deal.
Yeah. Well, either way, this is a huge deal. I think we all agree on that. And the mayor is, of course, as Lisa mentioned, he's scheduled to enter the Vatican for that meeting tomorrow morning at 8:30 Chicago time. So we are going to check in with Mariah again at 9 right here on In the Loop for the very latest. Now, Tom, last week, charges against a group of immigration protesters known as the Broadview Six, they were dropped. Now damage from that case is beginning to spread. What's going on?
Okay, so strap in here. last week, what the judge told the attorneys was that she was incredibly shocked by what she saw in grand jury transcripts. And what she saw was that a prosecutor had essentially put her credibility on the line to back the charges, that a prosecutor had communicated with grand jurors out of the grand jury room, that some grand jurors who disagreed with the case the government was bringing were dismissed, weren't allowed to continue, and that this behavior was apparently covered up. They redacted this out of the grand jury transcripts initially given to Perry. So, yeah, the charges were dropped. This was just a few days before the trial, and that was kind of just the start of the fallout. So the prosecutor who led the grand jury is named Sherry Mecklenburg, and she was, quote, terminated from her job with the Senate Judiciary Committee. She was detailed there. We have the U.S. attorney, Andrew Boutros, who's ordered a review of all these cases tied to the Broadview Six to see if there's other improprieties. And in one of those cases, an attorney has filed a motion asking a judge to drop the charges, citing what happened in the grand jury with Broadview Six. And that's the high-profile case of a Laredo hospital executive who's charged with earning hundreds of millions of dollars through a fraud scheme.
So everyone's looking at this as sort of the blueprint now, and they want the same treatment.
Yeah, there's questions. It was the same grand jury who heard the Loretto case.
I see.
There's questions if they were treated similarly when it came to that case.
So what happens next here, Tom?
Well, what happens next is lawyers are going to continue to file briefs, right? Defense attorneys are asking the government to preserve all of the Fed's communications about these grand jury proceedings. And there's this looming possibility of sanctions. And, you know, shouldn't be taken lightly. April Perry, the judge, she was a prosecutor in this office previously. And, you know, she has raised the idea or the specter of, you know, law licenses are on the line here. So the stakes are incredibly high. This is one of the biggest scandals to rock the Dirksen Federal Courthouse in many years. And yeah, it's going to continue to unfold and probably, you know, fold into other cases as well, is what it looks like.
Courtney, let's talk about the Civic Opera House, because people there are very, very happy today, and I want a little bit of joy, too. So give us the details on what's making them smile.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. This is Chicago's Lyric Opera, and they recently announced that the company has received a $20 million gift that comes from the Illinois-based Nagani Foundation. So certainly this is a big boost to the company and their efforts.
Yeah,
there.
Awesome. And a lot of smaller arts institutions, they've been struggling financially in the wake of the pandemic. We've talked about this a number of times.
Totally.
Give us the situation at Lyric Opera.
Yeah, sure. I think that opera is in an interesting place even beyond Chicago. We've seen the Metropolitan Opera in New York really struggling financially in recent years in a very public way. And that really is the country's leading opera company. And here at Lyric, there's new leadership. John Mangum is finishing just his second season as CEO and president of Lyric. And this gift comes after they received a really large gift last season as well. There was this $25 million gift last season from philanthropist Penelope Steiner. And so they've gotten these large donations, but opera is so expensive to produce. And I think it's also the art form is really sort of trying to find its next generation of loyal audience members as well. So there's a lot of really interesting specific struggles there.
Right, right. And what is the money reportedly going to be used for?
Yeah, sure. Half of it is going to go towards educational programming, so reaching students in schools or more family programming. And then the second half, $10 million, will go towards bringing a Mozart production to Lyric's main stage every year going forward. So it's a little bit an investment in those future audiences and then a little bit playing the hits with Mozart.
Now, the weather has been really nice lately,
Lisa. It has. Yeah.
But it's not all sunshine and rainbows, at least for some people.
Right.
What's going on?
So today, the National Weather Service is issuing this air quality alert for the Chicago area, also Northwest Indiana, through midnight tonight. The Illinois EPA declaring today an air pollution action day. There are unhealthy ozone levels, and this can happen when pollution interacts with sunlight. So you've got smog.
Okay. And so what makes up these sensitive groups?
Yeah. So this is bad for some people. The EPA says this can be harmful for people who might have lung or heart disease, you know, the conditions like asthma, older adults, children, teenagers, pretty much everybody out there, you know, that's a big group. Officials, though, advising people, you know, you should probably limit your time outdoors. Today might not be a bad option.
Yeah, well, it's going to be hard for us to limit our time outdoors, Courtney, because the kickoff for summer festivals has begun. We talked about this yesterday on WBEZ's Say More, but since we've got you here, I had to get your take. Which fests are on your to-do list over the next few months?
You know, I'm looking forward to Blues Fest, which is already next weekend, and they are going to do a big celebration this year of Alligator Records, Chicago's own.
Great. Like,
that's going to be fun.
Yeah, really cool. They're celebrating their 55th year. They're a Chicago label. They really are like the leading blues label, and so they're going to have a bunch of their artists on stage at once, which is very fun. This was a celebration that was supposed to happen during the pandemic. So now they're catching them on their 55th year instead of their 50th anniversary.
Hey,
so
never too
long
late.
Time coming. Yeah, for sure.
For sure. Any of these music fests or food festivals, your cup of tea, Lisa?
You know, the one that we typically go to, my husband and I, is the Jazz Fest, usually around Labor Day weekend,
totally.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends also who's performing, though. But it's really always really fun to see. I'm not a huge crowd fan, so I kind of have to, you know, get myself in that mental game if I want to go, but I wouldn't say no.
I'm right there with you. The big crowds, I just feel like I'm going to get squished.
Totally.
Tom, any festivals for you this summer?
Not so much festivals, but the Horner Park Farmers Market starts this weekend. So
nice.
I'll be very excited about that. And then I do want to go see Erykah Badu and De La Soul at Ravinia toward the end of the summer.
I might have to hop on that ticket there, Tom.
I love a Ravinia night.
I did not know that they were coming to Ravinia.
Yeah, take the train up there. Also, if you have a Ravinia ticket, you can ride the train for free, which is very nice.
Very cool.
Nice tip.
Is there a food fest that you love, Courtney?
Oh, well, Taste of Chicago is coming back to the middle of the summer this year, moving back to like primetime billing. It had been in the fall with NASCAR, but NASCAR's gone. Taste of Chicago back in July.
Back in July. Yeah, and I shall probably be there this time, finally.
Find Sasha there.
Other news that you're watching, Lisa?
Yeah, so let's bring some more joy, shall we, to the program. The Chicago Fire is so proud to announce that its goalkeeper, Chris Brady, headed to play in the World Cup for Team USA.
Very good.
Native of Naperville, so like
that's
we
awesome.
Have...
A round
isn't
of applause.
This great? Good for him. One of three goalies joining the U.S. roster. The Fire say Brady is the first designated homegrown player to be named to the FIFA World Cup roster in team history. So first, Team USA is going to be playing Germany at Soldier Field. It's a friendly match on June 6th, and then the team's first World Cup match Friday, June 12th. So
excellent.
I hope they win. You know?
That's good news. And Courtney, the Obama Presidential Center officially opens, as we know, on June 19th. And the Obama Foundation has unveiled its list of summer programming. Tell us what's on that list.
Oh my gosh, so much, Sasha. I feel like we've been talking about this for a long time.
I've been waiting.
Here it is, long time coming. That opening weekend, there's going to be all kinds of stuff that's available to the public. There's going to be live music, story time for families, a chance to hear from artists. Of course, a look at the vegetable garden, very on brand for former First Lady Michelle Obama. And then throughout the summer, there's going to be a film series tied to the nation's 250th birthday. There's going to be a celebration for former President Obama for his birthday. So much going on.
Oh, yes. Leo love.
A fellow Leo.
He's
of
my
yours,
fellow
Sasha.
Leo. That's right. That's right. All right. Well, Tom and Courtney, before I let you go, tell me what other news you're following. You first, Tom.
Oh, well, you know, I was sadly following the news about Schlitz beer being done for. And a freelancer for us, Zachary Noth, wrote a very touching and beautiful story about the last Schlitz being poured at a place near and dear to my heart, Schuba's Tavern.
right.
And it's a tough time for us Schlitz drinkers.
It is.
Some great reporting there.
I hope you're holding up well. Courtney, what about you?
I'm interested in this story that we have up on the website today about an auction happening of Tony Fitzpatrick's work. He's the late Chicago artist, and 70 of his art pieces are going to be auctioned off this week. So it'll be interesting to see more of his work sold out into the world.
Yeah. WBEZ's Courtney Kippers, Lisa Lavas, and Tom Schuba.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.